This is the English Heritage Podcast.
Hello and welcome to this latest podcast into England's past. I'm Charles Rowe. We have new episodes out every Thursday, so don't forget to subscribe to get automatic updates to your podcast feed. Today we return to the most famous date in English heritage, and that's 1066, when the Normans invaded England. And the Battle of Hastings took place between the armies of King Harold II and William, Duke of Normandy. It was a huge turning point in the country's history, the legacy of which can still be felt today. And with us to answer your questions about this fateful event are properties curator Roy Porter.
Hello, Charles.
And curator of collections and interiors for the South East region, Catherine Bedford.
Hello.
Now, before we get into the questions, we have covered different aspects of the story of the Battle of Hastings previously in episodes 130, 146 and 180, so make sure you listen to those too. But in the meantime, let's get started with some of our listeners' questions about the build-up to the battle. So John Daly on Facebook asks, why did Harold believe that he was more entitled to be king than William was?
In short, what Harold claimed was that the previous king, Edward the Confessor, had nominated him as his heir on his deathbed. That's what Harold claimed. Harold was able to persuade the leading English noblemen who were in London at the time, and the time was at the very beginning of 1066, right at the beginning of January, that that's what Edward had done. Harold, of course, was the most powerful man in the kingdom, and having persuaded the people in London that he was the nominated heir, he very swiftly had himself crowned. He was crowned with unseemly haste. In fact, so unseemly that some later commentators thought it was a bit dodgy, the speed with which he had placed a crown upon his head, or had been crowned by probably the Archbishop of York in this particular instance. That's why he thought he was more entitled to be king than William. It doesn't matter that William may have been promised a crown at some point in the past, which is what William said. What Harold said was that actually Edward had perhaps changed his mind, and that on his deathbed he had declared that Harold was his nominated heir. Whether that actually happened, of course, is a moot point. And it's interesting that William, or William's propagandists, never said it didn't happen. They simply said that the earlier promise to William was of greater standing than the deathbed bequest was. So that's the nature of the difference of opinion.
I think it's important to emphasise the fact that, as Roy mentioned, he had been crowned king, and the coronation isn't just a case of signing a bit of paper, it is an important religious sacrament. So by the point of the Battle of Hastings, he is the king. So whether or not he was the right king or not, he had gone through that whole process, he was the king.
That's also a valid point. Were there any witnesses to this deathbed scene, Roy?
There was a small group of people, including, very conveniently, people like King Harold's sister, who just happened to be married to Edward the Confessor. And in fact, our only real description of the scene comes in the life of Edward the Confessor, written for her. What's interesting about that description is that it's slightly ambiguous in terms of the language it uses. So rather than having Edward say, very clearly and forthrightly, Harold, you are my heir and you will be the next king, what it actually says are words to the effect that, I commend the kingdom to your protection. And you can imagine that, historians down the ages have debated what exactly did Edward mean by that. Did he mean you're the next king, or did he mean, you're going to protect the kingdom for the time being until William of Normandy, who is, of course, my heir, comes across and takes up the throne as his right, or you're going to protect the kingdom until such time as my closest living male relative, Edgar Atheling, comes of age and can become king. So a series of questions ensue because of the ambiguity of the language in our one description of that event. We have a visual description or portrayal of it as well. It appears in the Bayeux Tapestry.
Oh, it's highly complex, isn't it? And highly ambiguous. Read into it what you will, basically. So Marcus has a question. What role did religion play in the Norman invasion? This partly feeds into that previous question, really. But Catherine, do you want to start us off?
Well, it's not a question of sort of two different sides of that the battle is being fought over religion in any way. But religion is particularly important in terms of the symbolism and the arguments that are used by both sides. In particular, William claims authority in part from a vow that Harold has made that is has been done on, I think we're right that it's actually on some saints' relics.
Yeah.
So the vow that he's made is backed up by this. He's not just vowed it sort of in a random hall anyway. It's particularly a vow that is backed up with this religious authority. And certain Norman sources also claim that before he invaded, William got the blessing of the Pope and brought a papal banner with him. So there's all this sort of symbolism in the Norman cause that is saying that they have the religious authority to be there, that they are not invading, they are just carrying out what is already William's divine right.
Yes, so it's a promise which is imbued with divine strength, shall we say.
Yeah, religion is part of the justification.
Yeah, I think you can see why...
It's galvanised, I suppose.
Yeah, and you can see why William would be only too pleased to have sort of the blessing of the Pope, because, you know, there's the most important cleric in Christendom apparently supporting William and will buttress his claim that, and this is very much the claim put out there by the writers who support William, that he has right on his side as well as, you know, military might. You know, he is a righteous person. And in fact, it's interesting, Catherine mentioned the relics. On the day of the battle, William's described as wearing those relics around his neck. Now, this is a man who is flaunting his religiosity on the battlefield in a very, very prominent way. It is worth saying there's a countervailing point of view which sometimes gets put forward. And in fact, fairly recently, a really fascinating article been written by a historian called Dan Armstrong about 2 years ago, where he questions the available evidence about the papal banner. You know, it's quite a complicated argument, but essentially it boils down to whether we can trust the earliest Norman sources. And really the earliest Norman source in this instance is a chap called William of Poitiers, who had been a chaplain of William in Normandy. And it's he who gives us our first instance of a papal banner being given to William. And the argument goes that perhaps papal support in the banner was given to William, but not until after the battle. In other words, this is the papacy sort of after the event, finding a way of accommodating and justifying this awful bloody battle which had happened and the conquest which happens in 1066. And in which case, the sort of leading date for the banner being if offered to William would be around 1070, which is at the same time as the church imposes some quite considerable penances on William and his followers so that they can atone for the great sins they've committed in their campaign of invading England.
Very interesting. Is there anything you'd like to add about the role of religion, Catherine?
I think that we need to take into account the extent to which in this period religion and statehood are not necessarily the same as they are now. And also in terms of William is arguing that he's not going to a foreign country. He's arguing that he is taking what is his natural right from a usurper. So that's a very different thing in terms of the justification behind it. He would not argue that it was an invasion. He was just going and taking his due, which was he was having to take by force simply because somebody else who had broken an oath that had been made on relics had taken from him by force.
So he was just basically moving someone out of the way. Okay,
yeah.
Interesting. And did Harold have any kind of religious claim as well?
Well, I mean, Harold, you know, by contemporary terms, from what we can judge from the available sources, is as godly as William. I mean, he's a patron of religious houses, for example. And as Catherine has said, you know, in terms of having God on your side, well, he is the anointed king of England. He's gone through that ceremony and received the chrism. So manifestly, he would say that, you know, God has supported his claim to the throne because the Archbishop of York has crowned him at the beginning of 1066. And I think for both men in this instance, you know, you couldn't say one is ungodly compared to the other. And as Catherine said right at the start, this isn't sort of a, and I think this is absolutely right, actually, this isn't a religious argument. This is a question of succession. So that William is able to put that question in terms which suggest that Harold has gone against the rules, essentially, and that those rules include rules which pertain to the church. And as Catherine just said, it's about swearing an oath on holy relics and then breaking that oath. And there is a sort of a legalistic argument here that by having sworn an oath in that way and broken it, he has broken the Christian peace. And therefore, William, as a legitimate ruler, is almost duty bound to punish Harold. And I suppose, you know, if you want to put some special pleading in for the Pope, you know, he may be supporting William's cause. It doesn't mean that he's anticipating everything which is going to happen as a consequence of William invading in October 1066. And I think it is fair to say that the extent of what follows, both at the Battle of Hastings and afterwards, wasn't anticipated by many people. It's a far bloodier and more long drawn out and ultimately far more damaging affair for the English than perhaps many people would have guessed would be the case when William sets out at the end of September.
In terms of religious claims then, do you think it's 50-50?
Probably it would have been, but of course Harold wasn't around to make his claims. Mm. So the sources that we're seeing are the ones where William is claiming to have religious right on his side. Harold hasn't had the opportunity within the sources to make similar claims for himself, but he undoubtedly would have done so.
How contemporaneous are those sources, Roy? Are they quite late after the event? Or
the difficulty we have is that the earliest sources all tend to be Norman or French. And in terms of any real merit in terms of description. So it's not until towards the end of the 11th century that you start to find people who we might refer to as English or Anglo-Norman who are beginning to write accounts which present, you know, a more favourable account for Harold. So our earliest sources, the ones which are closest to the event, are those which are very pro-William and, as a consequence, demolish Harold's claim.
Okay. Fascinating questions there to start us off. Mm. Let's move on to the characteristics of the battle. An intriguing question from Geoffrey Marcoux via Facebook, who says, I'm studying this at the moment, the Battle of Hastings, and I wonder if some of the families who fought with William actually lived in England before joining William's forces. Do you think that's possible?
This subject is going to come up again in a few of the other questions later on. So I think it's worth having a conversation about how the extent to which we know who was actually fighting in the battle and who fought with William, because actually this in itself is a very complex question to answer, because there are probably only about maybe 35 people on William's side and 20 on Harold's side that we can say with any confidence who was there. We don't even know how many people overall fought. So our ability to answer questions like this has to an extent to be speculative. There are a number of attempts that have been made over the centuries to list people that were there. Particularly famously, when it comes to the Battle of Hastings, we've got the Battle Abbey Roll, of which many copies survive. It was supposedly based on the muster roll that William took before the battle and was eventually sort of put up at the abbey so that the monks could pray for the souls of those who had fought there. But the earliest surviving copy of that roll is from the 1330s in the Auchinleck manuscript. So that's quite a lot of time later. And we know for a fact that some of the names that are on that, the families didn't come over from France until a couple of centuries later. There are 550 odd names on that version. There are multiple other versions going up to 629 names. There's a French version of the list. It was actually produced in the early 20th century that has 300 and something names. So it's very, very difficult to make any kind of specific comments about exactly who was fighting at that battle, because we've simply not got the level of detail that we would ideally have to be able to answer those kinds of questions.
So between about 300 and 500 different names across different time periods that these effectively team sheets are produced.
Yeah, and some of those sheets are certainly being produced on the basis of, that's a French sounding name, therefore they probably came over with William. So it becomes self-perpetuating, particularly in terms of this question. If French sounding names are the ones that are being put on the list, that is already implying that it's French people that must have been in the army, not anybody who wasn't with a French sounding name. And you've also got sort of the fact that a lot of people wanted to be associated with the conquest, wanted to be able to trace their family back to being part of that original army with William. So there was a certain status that went with it. And there's certainly a very strong suggestion that people would pay to have their family names added to the list.
Makes the family crest look a lot brighter, doesn't it, when you've got it on your nice house or whatever. Or yeah. You can move into political circles and get some access to land and influence and that sort of thing.
That's sort of the equivalent of the American families who want to all be connected to who came over on the original ship coming over. It's that kind of, we can trace ourselves back to the origin of the country. We have been here forever. We are established.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So I guess we can't really answer Geoffrey's question then, really.
We can't say for certain whether or not, because obviously you've got other sources that can help, things like the Doomsday Book, where you can see that obviously there's a massive changeover in personnel in terms of Norman people rather than the Saxon people that might have been working the land before. But that doesn't mean that somebody who was a Saxon person who continued in ownership had fought for William. There's sort of this big period of time in between. So you can't even make that kind of comment.
Do you think William would have had some contacts in England who...
Well, undoubtedly, because part of the Norman-English connection in this period grew out of the fact that Edward the Confessor had spent a lot of his youth in Normandy before he became king, whilst he was in exile. And when he became King of England, he did bring in people that he had known whilst he was in Normandy for a number of tasks. There was cross-channel movement happening before the conquest. So there may well have been people in England already who ultimately were more supportive of William than of Harold. What we don't have is specific evidence of people in England joining William's forces that I've come across anyway.
So just a theoretical possibility, we'll say.
I mean, it's dangerous to argue from silence, isn't it? But I can't help but think that if there were, you know, if there were people of importance of Norman heritage in this country who came across to William, I think we'd probably find a mention of them in the surviving Norman accounts. There is a mention of one person. I mean, this is probably as close as we can get to answering this particular question, but William of Poitiers, I've already mentioned, in his account, he describes how a person called Robert, whose name is Robert Fitzwilliamark, who was Norman, had become established in Essex in the 1050s, actually sends a messenger to William when William has invaded before the Battle of Hastings. And his message is basically to say, look, Harold has just defeated the Norwegians at the Battle of Stamford Bridge, and he is marching down south towards you. And I advise you, if you want to be prudent about things, get behind the walls of your fortified camp and stay there, which apparently doesn't go down too well with William, because, you know, it suggests that William would be a coward if he did that sort of thing. But what's interesting is that Robert continues to enjoy favour in William the Conqueror's reign. So he obviously doesn't fall out with the king. And it's one instance where you do have an example of a Norman who has come to England in Edward the Confessor's reign, who obviously feels sufficient loyalty to the Duke of Normandy that he wants to warn William about what he's about to face as Harold moves south. I think it's also interesting, though, that Robert doesn't actually travel into Sussex himself to actively support William. You know, what he appears to be doing is sending a messenger and sort of standing back and almost waiting to see how events are going to turn out. And I imagine that for a lot of people of Norman extraction who had, you know, been established in England since the 1050s or even the 1040s, that's probably what they're going to do, isn't it? They're going to stand back and see which way the wind is going to blow eventually and come down on the winning side. Because if they nail their colours to William's mast and William is ignominiously defeated and sent back across the English Channel or worse, it's not going to be too good for them and for their landholdings in England.
Yes, of course. Very prudent to do that, I think, I would say. Okay, very interesting. So it's a possibility that we had Normans who were based in England fighting with William against the Saxons, effectively, and Harold's men. So it's a possibility.
A possibility, but as I said, unlikely to be anyone of particularly high status. Mm. So I wouldn't necessarily say probability, because someone of lower status is going to have difficulty maybe knowing what's happening and where the battle is and how to get there and that sort of thing. Mm.
Okay. Related to this, Barclay Albright and Ewan Clement on Facebook have similar questions, asking if any men who lost at the Battle of Stamford Bridge, which you mentioned, Roy, in which Harold defeated the invading Norwegian king Harald Hardrada, did they subsequently take part in the Battle of Hastings? So were there Battle of Stamford Bridge men fighting in the Battle of Hastings?
Okay, well, in terms of the way the question's been put, you know, specifically asking if any of the people who lost at the Battle of Stamford Bridge, so in other words, the Norwegian army of Harald Hardrada, whether they fought at the Battle of Hastings, I think that, as far as I'm aware, there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that happened. There's nothing to say that the remnant of Harald Hardrada's army travelled south. I mean, certainly wouldn't have travelled over land through the country. If they were at Hastings, they would have sailed south and, you know, landed. And that sort of implies they know exactly where William is and they know how to join him. And that sort of level of foreknowledge just doesn't appear to exist in terms of how the picture's presented in the historic sources. You know, I think the people who lost and that survived the Battle of Stamford Bridge probably made their way home across the North Sea as quickly as possible. They were a much depleted force, and I don't think they're really in any position to continue fighting against King Harold. The more interesting question, of course, is what about the other side? What about the people who won the Battle of Stamford Bridge, which, of course, is Harold himself? Well, Harold, there's one example. Harold was at the Battle of Stamford Bridge, and he was at the Battle of Hastings, so that's definitely the case. And I think for the nucleus of the army around Harold, his inner circle, his housecarls, they're probably going to be at the Battle of Hastings, and they're the people who famously have to make their way back from Yorkshire to London for a few days and then down into Sussex to fight this next battle. They're people who are going to be riding on horseback, of course. They'll have the opportunity to make that journey and to get down there as quickly as possible. But our Norman sources, they seek to emphasise the great size of the English army, and they tell us that it was assembled from all the shires. But interestingly, our one Anglo-Norman source, William of Malmesbury, he tells us, and this may answer partly the question, he tells us that Harold's army was depleted on the march south from Stamford Bridge. And interestingly, he puts this down to Harold failing to share booty won in the battle. So he's upset some of the people who'd fought with him at Stamford Bridge. And as a result, William of Malmesbury says that many people slipped away as Harold marched south. So, you know, you put that together, the fact that, you know, in order to fight William, Harold would have called up the Fjord, effectively the army of the nation. I think, and it'll be interesting to hear what Catherine thinks, but I think it's far more likely that the greater number of English who were fighting at the Battle of Hastings were raised from the southern counties of the country.
I'd agree, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. I suspect that the greater number of those, the people are coming from that local area, but then, as you say, it's that core group of the most highly trained, the leaders, who are the ones that have been coming down. Mm. I mean, just the distances that they were having to travel per day, they're coming down to London about a rate of about 27 miles a day or something, yeah, like that. For foot soldiers, for archers, that's a very different thing to people who are riding on horses.
Yes, and it's not an incentive, is it, for someone who lives in the north of England to go and defend the south of England when they don't live there and they probably don't really care, do they?
Well, they would do. And I have to remember as well that Harold had an army called up on the south coast waiting for William to arrive, which he had to disperse to allow them to go back to their farms before he then sort of was gathering an army again to go up to Stamford Bridge and then coming back down again. So I think the people that he's gathering, the sources talk about him gathering people en route. So he's gathering people sort of as he can, as that can get there. And that is partly being done sort of, I suspect, on a geographical basis. It's the people that he can get to within the timeframes that he's dealing with. Mm.
That collection of soldiers sounds hurried and slightly disorganised, doesn't it?
Well, there was a very strong system in place for raising men, so that was sort of how armies were raised in the period. People were used to doing that. There had been one raised only, I think, a year earlier by Edward. So the system was in place, but in this instance, the speed with which Harold is having to react is slightly more unusual.
So basically unlikely that people who'd come over from Norway to fight in the Battle of Stamford Bridge would be fighting in the Battle of Hastings for either side.
Very unlikely, also because it's two totally separate armies with two totally separate claims on the throne as well. People that were fighting for Harald Hardrada thought that he should be king. They didn't mean that they thought that William should be king.
No.
It was they were fighting for Harald Hardrada rather than they were fighting against Harold Godwinson.
Well, let's talk about how the battle was fought and move on to talk about weapons. The Normans, of course, had a cavalry, which was key. Related to that, Catherine, with a C, asks, how did the Normans manage to get so many horses on and off their ships? Do they have special ships, I suppose?
Okay, so horse transport in this period, there's a certain amount of evidence, but we don't have huge amounts that are particularly specific to this period. There is an image within the Bayeux Tapestry that appears to show horses on a ship and then horses coming off a ship, but doesn't give detail in terms of how they are being transported in the ship and what the mechanism by which they come off is. So we have to look to other information about what's happening. Particularly, we've got information around what's happening within the Mediterranean, which does include other branches of the Normans, the same group of people. So they're a fairly good comparison. The Romans had developed quite good methods for transporting horses by sea. And those horse transport ships, they could be rowed or they could be by sail, but they basically worked on a principle of storing horses apparently within fabric slings on the ships to keep them contained. And then stores could be dropped down and horses would be led off in a very controlled fashion at the other end. So you've got these specially adapted boats rather than specially built boats to allow horses to be moved by sea. And each one could only carry a limited number of horses. So the current assessment is there'd be between 1,000 and 2,000 cavalry within William's army. So we're having to transport that many horses across the channel. And there could normally be, from what we can tell, up to about 30 horses on one of these ships. So that kind of gives you an idea of the number of ships that has to be involved in getting the number of horses across.
Yes, I'm just doing the calculations. So 66 ships, roughly.
It's quite a lot, actually, when you start thinking about the number of horses. And one thing to say as well is that horses in this period are smaller than what we tend to think of as war horses today. The size of a war horse in this period had been only sort of 14, 15 hands. So that actually, by modern standards, is actually a large pony. So we're not thinking sort of big shire horses and massive horses that we might think of automatically as war horses from medieval films, for example. These are relatively small horses by modern standards that are being transported.
And when you're talking about these slings, are you saying that the horses were somehow suspended while travelling on ship?
Not so much suspended as controlled. So it's not that they were sort of lifted their feet off the ground, but each horse would not have been able to move forwards or backwards or sideways, particularly because this sort of fabric sling would be holding their body in place.
Oh, I see. So it's sort of like a sleeve that stops them from losing their footing and knocking all the other ones over, I suppose, or something.
Yeah, so if one panics, there can't be any kind of stampede within the boat.
Okay, I understand. So they're all wrapped in one sling, would that be right?
No, so one sling per horse.
One sling per horse, okay. And then that's attached to one of the bulkheads or something, is it? Or
yeah, I mean, possibly imagine, if you've seen sort of ships with hammocks in, similar kind of idea, but obviously they're not hammocks, they're much deeper things. So you've got kind of, they'd be suspended from above. There is some suggestion that horses would have been, in some cases, on the deck as well. But again, these things would have been constructed in a different way for that, because there wouldn't be anything for them to be suspended from. But that's the kind of mechanisms that we're talking about. And then say they'd be taken out in the order that they went in to allow them to be walked off the boats.
So potentially a two-tier ship where you've got a top deck and then you've got a lower deck, and they could be stored on either level.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to another question from Yon, I think it is, O'Reilly from Facebook, wants to know why the Saxons didn't use caltrops against Norman cavalry, given that these were a Roman invention and were used again in the medieval period. So we probably need to say what caltrops are.
Well, caltrops are really nasty. That's the first thing to say. They're horrible things. They're metal spiked objects, okay? So it's sort of the classic medieval version of this. You could have something as simple as four nails fixed together, fused together, in such a way that if you place them on the ground, there's always a spike pointing upwards. So imagine placing all these metallic spikes on the ground, and you could put them in front of advancing cavalry, and you can imagine very easily, can't you, just what a terrible effect that would have on horses as their riders drove them unknowingly onto these horrible, horrible, disabling objects, because their feet would be cut open literally as they stumbled on these. And of course, the consequence of that is that the horse would stop, fall, the rider would fall, the rider would become vulnerable, and then you could attack the formerly mounted knight on the ground. So, you know, as we've been asked, you know, why didn't the English use these? Well, assuming for the time being the English had anticipated the Norman use of cavalry in the battle, I think the answer really lies in the lack of time the English had to prepare for the battle. The English sources suggest that their deployment was a very rushed affair. And even the Norman ones say that the English sought to rush on them and take them by surprise. And I don't think there was time for extensive defensive preparation before the battle, other than establishing a battle line and forming a shield wall. I suppose it's also worth saying that the use of horses by the English in warfare is still a, you know, quite a contested subject for historians. You know, that there are some people who are of the view that it didn't happen. There are other historians who say, well, actually, there are some pointers in the evidence towards the English using cavalry in attacks, particularly in the reign of Edward the Confessor, interestingly. But just supposing that the English aren't as used to using horses in warfare, would they have been as familiar as we're assuming with caltrops? It's an interesting question. It may be the case that there wasn't such a great familiarity with them in 1066. You know, the trouble is we're arguing from silence, aren't we? We don't know why they didn't use them. And you can put up any number of reasons why that might be the case. You know, for example, if the English are rushing down to battle, it could be that their wagon full of caltrops is still on the road on the way down at the time when the battle's being fought. We just don't know. But, you know, personally, I think it speaks of a lack of time in being able to prepare literally the ground in front of them before William's army attacks.
Mm. Do you agree with that, Catherine?
Yeah, I mean, I would possibly go even further in saying we're arguing from a lack of evidence that they weren't used. How do we know they weren't used? Just because they weren't mentioned. They clearly weren't used in a way that was decisive and worth mentioning, but that doesn't mean there weren't a few lying around. I would say as well that whilst the question is absolutely right that the caltrops were used by the Romans, even within the time that the Romans were using them, they're never ubiquitous in battle. They're not something that is suitable for every occasion. They're very much a defensive weapon. So for an army that is setting up at short notice on the top of a hill, they're not building defensive ditches. They're not actually setting up defences in a particular sense. So it may be that even if they had some, they didn't think that they were suitable on this occasion.
Fair enough. Okay, let's move on to talk about some other weapons. Ranged weapons are here. What ranged weapons did the two sides have, and what difference did these make? This is from David Irwin via Facebook.
Well, I suppose, you know, we ought to start with the most famous of the ranged weapons used at the Battle of Hastings, which, of course, is the bow. Both sides would have had archers with them, although they're particularly associated with the Normans, of course. And in fact, probably our earliest source for the battle, the Carmen or Song of the Battle of Hastings, the author of that relishes describing how archers were used in William's infantry as skirmishing troops, and he describes the terrible damage they caused to the English line. And in fact, both the Carmen and the William of Poitiers also mentioned the use of crossbows at the same time as well. So we should say that crossbows along with bows were being used by William's forces. I suppose in terms of, you know, what difference these things made, it's quite difficult to say, really, because, you know, we all know the story, don't we, of King Harold being killed by an arrow in the eye. I'm sure we're going to talk about that later on. I think, you know, there's some questions about that coming up. And, you know, there are all sorts of things which have entered the popular consciousness about the Battle of Hastings. You know, for example, I'm sure many of our listeners will have heard of how the Norman archers purposely fired high into the air to fire over the shield wall and for their arrows to land on the English, who wouldn't be able to protect themselves against infantry and cavalry and arrows falling down from above at the same time. That particular story emerges about 100 years after the battle, or at least it's recorded 100 years after the battle by a writer called Wace. And I'm not persuaded that he's actually describing something which actually happened on the day of the battle. I think they're trying to understand how it was that Harold was possibly killed by an arrow in his eye. I think, you know, it's difficult to see through the fog of the sources in this way. And also, if the ranged weapons, or at least the bows, you know, the bows and crossbows of William had a really decisive effect, well, then you have to say, well, it took a long time for it to work out, because this is a battle which starts at 9 a.m. and ends at dusk. It's not as if, you know, these things are the weapons which give William or make victory easy for William, because they certainly didn't. What is true is that, you know, the Bear Tapestry, I think, only depicts one English archer, compared to all the Normans. It looks like the English, from the bare tapestries, that the English had far fewer archers. And again, it's been suggested that perhaps this is because archers are low down the social scale. They would be riding on horses, so they could well still be traveling to the battlefield on the day that it's fought. But the English made good their absence in part by improvising. They sort of make semi-ranged weapons, if you like, by making objects which they can throw at the Normans. And some of these are entirely orthodox. You have spears being thrown in the battle. They're described in the sources, but also axes being thrown. And things as simple as getting stones and tying them to sticks and lobbing them at the approaching forces as they come up the hill. And in fact, the Bayeux Tapestry shows things like that being thrown from the English line towards the Normans.
High ground, which was held by Harold, should have presented an advantage. How did Harold manage to lose the battle then? This is a question from Mark.
Well, it's one advantage that he had, but he had disadvantages in terms of he'd just been, his army had been travelling down. They hadn't potentially sort of not rested in the way that's often described, the sort of the rush down from Stamford Bridge. The high ground is indeed an advantage, but that doesn't mean that it's an overwhelming advantage that automatically means that he should have won. And there are all sorts of reasons why he might not have done. Down probably to the events on the day and the famous, whether it was deliberate or an accident, there's some debates about that one. The whole idea of the Norman retreat that enticed the Saxons, the British down off the hill and allowed the shield wall to break. And that obviously is the really decisive moment.
Yes, because then they were all scattered, weren't they? And that shield wall was disintegrated and it was then kind of pick off who you like. Is that accurate, Roy?
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting, though. When you actually read the detailed descriptions of the battle, it appears to continue for some time after those feigned retreats. And I think, you know, whilst part of Harold's line was obviously destabilized by that, it's not the end of the battle. They're still fighting afterwards. And I think the fact that they're fighting afterwards just shows just what an advantage Harold enjoyed in the position he adopted. But contrary to that, there are one or two signs that that position was inherently flawed.
Really?
Yeah, there are, yeah. You'd expect this. This comes from English sources. Okay, so as far as the Normans are concerned, Harold is given every advantage possible, but William still beats him, because that shows you just how brilliant the soldier and general William is. But according to the English sources, Harold has some major disadvantages. And one of them, according to a chronicler called John of Worcester, is that they were fighting in a space which was too narrow for Harold to deploy his army properly. He actually says that, you know, as a consequence, many of Harold's army fell away from the line and fell away from the battle. They retire from the battle. That might be special pleading, but if it's true, it suggests that the place Harold was defending was actually too tight to form up properly. Okay, so there's a disadvantage he may be suffering from. The other thing the English sources go out of their way to say, really, is that he was numerically outnumbered. You know, he's at a disadvantage numerically. He rushes down to Sussex, hot on the victory of Stamford Bridge. You know, you can imagine his sure success. God has granted him victory in the north against Harald Hardrada. He's going to do it against William by surprising William. He rushes down, but according to John of Worcester, he rushes down before half of his army had assembled. And the Anglo-Saxon, one of the versions of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle says the same thing, that he fought against William before all of his army came up. If that's the case, then you have a combination of fighting in a confined space with a depleted force around you. You can see that there are some disadvantages he's suffering at the outset. Of course, I think we should really say that if you were to ask a contemporary why Harold lost the battle, despite the advantages of the high ground, a lot of them would say, well, of course, it's because God wanted William to win. It comes back to that idea of righteousness, doesn't it? And that's exactly what the Norman accounts say. It obviously demonstrates that providence is on William's side. But the interesting thing, I think, is that when the English come to write about this a generation later, people like Henry of Huntingdon writing in the 1120s, even they say that God wanted William to win as well. They don't necessarily agree with William's claim to the throne, but these people who are sort of monks and clerics, they're drawn to identifying God's plan being executed in worldly events. And for them, the way they see it is William is an instrument of God's vengeance on the sinful English nation.
Harold's death, though, is recorded, as you've been saying, Roy, as this arrow to the eye in the Bayeux or Bayeux tapestry, depending on how you like to pronounce it. Has this story now been dismissed, asks Les. Do you want to answer that one, Catherine?
Well, we did actually discuss this topic in quite a bit of detail in the previous podcast that Roy and I did. So it might be worth people wanting to a lot of detail on it to go and have a listen to that one. Just briefly here, I will say that it hasn't been dismissed in that you will absolutely still find people who argue that that was the case. But I think most historians would say we simply do not know how Harold died based on the information that we have available to us. The sources are slightly contradictory. The earlier ones suggest that he was cut up on the field. The idea of the arrow through the eyes is slightly later. And the depiction of his death in the Bayeux tapestry is extremely problematic in a number of ways. And there are two potential figures who could be Harold dying on that panel. And also, as I discussed in the previous podcast, the arrow as it appears in the tapestry as it is now is actually a 19th century reconstruction that was done during conservation works on the tapestry. And the photograph that exists of the tapestry before that reconstruction work doesn't actually show an arrow at that point. So I think that whilst we can't say he definitely didn't die in that way, I don't think that there'd be many people who would say confidently that he did.
Too many conflicting pieces of evidence, shall we say, there, which I suppose you'd have to ignore, really. After the battle, though, let's focus on what happened then. Andrea has a question. What happened to Harold's body after he was killed? Do we definitely know about that?
Well, again, we don't definitely know. I mean, we definitely know very, very little about the Battle of Hastings. There are lots of things we sort of think we know about, but very little we definitely know. I mean, the earliest accounts describe how Harold's body is found after the battle, and that William arranges it for it to be buried on cliffs overlooking the coast, despite entreaties from Harold's mother for her to be granted the body for respectful burial. William refuses that. And you have all these descriptions, by the way, talk about how difficult it is to identify Harold's body, which goes back to the point Catherine was making about the earlier sources talking about Harold being cut down on the battlefield. I mean, the balance of evidence, it seems to me, suggests he was horribly mutilated. They can't actually identify him other than by certain marks on his body, you know, intimate marks. And the story of what happens to his body changes over time. So those early sources talk about William taking the body away and burying it. By the early 12th century, we're told that he's far more magnanimous and he allows Harold's mother to take the body away and it's buried at Waltham Abbey. And in fact, by the end of the 12th century, by the 1170s, the monks at Waltham Abbey are telling another story entirely, which is that two of their monks were at the battle and that Harold was a patron of theirs and that they wanted to give his body a respectful burial, but they couldn't identify it. So what do they do? Well, they go to Harold's former concubine, his former girlfriend, Edith Swanneck, and she's brought to the battlefield. And because of her intimate knowledge of Harold's body, she's able to identify it by certain marks on it, and that then the body is taken away to Waltham Abbey. So I think if you were to ask most people by the end of the 12th century what had happened to Harold's body, it was at Waltham Abbey, and the monks of Waltham Abbey certainly appear to have believed that. But it's not what our earlier sources say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Gets a bit nebulous, doesn't it, after the events. Barbara Bryant asks on Facebook, what role did women play, either during the battle itself or in its aftermath? But you've sort of answered that partly there, Roy, haven't you, with the Waltham Abbey story and the concubine. But any other women featuring in records?
Very few in terms of the battle itself. There are only three women that appear in the whole of the Bayeux tapestry, other than kind of some nudes around the side who aren't part of the scenes. One of those is a woman who is depicted taking a child away, so just before the battle arrives, which implies kind of local people getting out of the way of the battle. So that's one role that women played in that case, in those sort of looking after the children whilst men may be dealing with the battle. Women would also have been involved in the care of the sick and the dead after the battle, those who'd been wounded, and the laying out of the dead potentially as well. But we really have no information as to that kind of thing in detail because we simply don't have the sources that speak to it. Women, of course, were heavily involved in the political events in the run-up to the battle, and they appear to have taken on a symbolic role. It's actually one of the versions of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, because there are several, but one of the versions, version D, sort of takes a short break in the story in 1067 and talks about the fate of some of the royal women. And it's almost like the women are being used to symbolise the changes that have taken place in the country. So they talk about the mother and sister of Edgar Atheling, one of the other claimants, moving up to Scotland. They talk about Githa, the mother of Harold, moving out of the country. And then immediately after that, they depict Matilda, the wife of William, coming into the country and being crowned queen, even though that didn't actually happen until a year later. So all the women's stories are being compressed. These previous royal women are moving out of the country and William's wife is coming in. So women there are not taking part in the battle, but they are absolutely symbolising the changes that have taken place.
Do you think women would also, who may have lost their partners or husbands in battle, do you think they would find themselves being claimed by the victors as well?
They're definitely being used in as a mechanism for land transfer.
And perhaps building new families as well. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, it's quite interesting that moment within the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle speaking of women does not actually mention any of the royal women that stay in England. So Queen Edith, for example, doesn't feature there, even though she stays in the country and was having written the life of Edward the Confessor that Roy mentioned earlier. The women that are staying put and are being effectively assimilated into the new political reality are invisible in that sense.
Fascinating question though from Barbara, so thank you for that. Let's move on to a set of questions about possible different timelines emerging if things went differently. William Ritchie from X, formerly Twitter, asks whether Harold could have improved his chances if he'd waited longer after the Battle of Stamford Bridge to face William. What do you think, Roy?
Yes, very probably is what I think. I mean, we've already discussed, haven't we, about the disadvantages the English sources suggest Harold suffered from as a consequence of rushing down to battle. Smaller army than he would have had, being perhaps the most important. And it's interesting that, you know, some of those English sources actually talk about how his family tried to dissuade him from rushing to confront William. A writer called Orderic Vitalis, who's writing again in the early 12th century, tells us that his brother Gyrth actually suggested that he rather than Harold should fight the Duke, and that his mother tried to dissuade Harold from going leaving London, and that Harold got very angry at this and, you know, basically pushed them out of the way and made sure that he was going to be going as quickly as possible. And you know, in a sense, you know, that is one of Harold's, you know, in retrospect, one of Harold's big errors, because it's William who really required the quicker victory. You know, William is in a foreign land, having to ravage the land around him to find forage for his horses and food for his followers. And as the autumn turns into the winter, he's going to be in a more and more difficult situation. In a sense, all Harold has to do is to keep him contained down in the Hastings Peninsula, and William's situation will get worse and worse and worse. And yet, you know, Harold takes the bait and rushes down to fight William, and I think it was a big mistake.
Under the Ancient You on Instagram is curious to know, how close were we to having a different outcome?
Well, I think it would have been very interesting if Harold hadn't died. Mm. Because even if Harold had lost, but had survived that battle, because it's not like the English immediately went, hurrah, William, you are our king now. They went ahead and turned to Edgar Atheling instead. Instead of having a child as a potential alternative, if they'd had a living Harold, a adult man with military experience and personal loyalties that the English would rally around again for a second battle or a series of campaigns, I think that that would have made a big difference.
What are your thoughts, Roy?
I agree entirely with that. I mean, I think it's the death of Harold which seems to have broken the English resolve at the Battle of Hastings. It's when their leader is killed and news of that gets out that, you know, we're told that they break and flee from the battle. So, you know, personal support for Harold was strong in many quarters, if not universal. Again, there's some interesting suggestions in the sources that it wasn't universal. And, you know, even if Harold had been killed, what if one of his brothers had survived? He had two brothers fighting with him at the Battle of Hastings, both of whom were killed. So I suppose the great disaster for the English is that, you know, many of their natural leaders, the people you would put at the forefront of being leading contenders to continue the fight are wiped out at the Battle of Hastings. But, you know, it really was, it was a closely fought battle. I mean, I think all the accounts of it describe a closely fought battle. And there's a monk at Canterbury called Eadna who was writing around the year 1100. And he actually says that French people in his day who were at the battle still talk about how close it was, about how fortune swayed now on this side and then on the other, and that ultimately it was the miraculous intervention of God which granted victory to William. Now, you know, if they're saying it as a closely run thing, I think we need to take their word for it.
Mm-hmm. Yon O'Reilly on Facebook has a second question asking, what would have happened to William and the Norman army if William had lost?
In this scenario, has William survived?
Well,
up at Stamford Bridge, Harold had rather did not.
What do you think, based on the two scenarios then? So assuming William died.
Assuming William dies, his army are effectively going to be routed and pushed back to the coast and flee back to Normandy. If William survives, then he's likely to have tried to continue his campaign.
But the chances might have been against him with the season changing and also having to plunder farms.
Season changing, loss of personnel, loss of equipment.
Yes.
Again, as Catherine said earlier, there are so many variables here and you could invent a whole load of scenarios. Here's one for you where the battle has been fought. It's been a closely won thing. Harold hasn't died and effectively William at the end of the day has been forced back into his camp at Hastings. His army is much depleted. Harold's army, you know, is full of the joy of victory, essentially. They move around and surround Hastings. William doesn't have an opportunity to bring resources into Hastings because Harold's managed to bring his navy into the channel and to blockade Hastings. And yet William has enough forces to make a direct assault a hazardous thing. What's Harold going to do? I think what Harold will do is negotiate terms with William. And this is what you see English kings doing, you know, in the time of Ethred the Unready, for example, coming to terms with Viking raiders. It's what William the Conqueror himself will do in just a few years' time when he's facing invasion from Scandinavia. He will pay off people who are invading. And I think in this instance, they will come to terms. If Harold is in a strong enough position, he will take hostages from William in order to guarantee William's better and good behavior in the future. So maybe members of William's family, close friends, will be taken as hostages, and the Normans will go back across the sea, promising not to try an invasion in the future. And Harold will, for the next few years, be looking over his shoulder, hoping that they're not going to come back. There you go. There's a scenario for you.
Wow, that's fascinating. A possible personal connection to the Battle of Hastings now from one of our listeners. Rachel Eyre on Facebook says, there's a legend in her family that an ancestor, True Love, fought with William and that he released William's visor to prevent William from suffocating. It's also said that lands in Derbyshire were granted to the ancestor afterwards and that this man lost a leg, which is indicated in the family crest. Is any of this true? Is there any known connection between the Eyre family and William the Conqueror via this ancestor called True Love? Have you done any homework on this one, Catherine? You must have been up all night.
Yes, this is the sort of thing that I absolutely love. And yes, I did have a look into this and I'm very sorry, Rachel, but no, it's not true, but it's still fascinating why it's not true.
Okay.
So starting with what we're deliberately being told in the question itself, which is about the man losing his leg and that's being mentioned in the family crest, it's worth mentioning that coats of arms didn't actually exist until about 200 years after the Battle of Hastings. So the kind of direct connection of this happened in this battle leading on to the coat of arms is something that inherently is a bit suspect to see in this time period. And the story as a whole is one that when you are used to reading a lot of histories, it very much feels 19th century. There's a move in the 19th century to explain things through looking back to history. And there are certain stories that after a while you get a sense that feels 19th century. And this is one of those. But looking into the family history of the Eyre family and this particular legend, there is actually a huge amount of information about the Eyre family, partly because they were a noble family, and then a noble family that moved to America and became a very important political family. So there's been a huge amount of research that's been done on them. So I do suggest to anyone who's interested, have a look, go at the genealogy websites and family history stuff, and also just having a really good search of the internet in general. There's a lot out there in terms of the history of this family. And it can be traced all the way back to 1066, or at least to just after it. It's possible to trace it back to an individual who appears in Domesday, not named Truelove. His name is Edward. And actually, it appears from Domesday that this was a Saxon who has retained his lands. So far from being on William's side, the Battle of Hastings, there's a decent chance that he actually would have been on the other side, but managed to retain his role post-conquest. And actually, there are two versions of this particular myth in this family. So not only did an ancestor supposedly save William at the Battle of Hastings and lose his leg and therefore get this particular coat of arms, apparently a member of the family also saved Richard the Lionheart when he was on the Third Crusade and lost his leg and got the coat of arms that way. So this is very much showing you what is happening in terms of family histories and family legends. They are pulling on important moments in history and connecting themselves to it. And the Battle of Hastings and Richard the Lionheart are the two most mythologized moments in medieval history. So the fact that one family is connecting to both of them, I think, is wonderful. But it really shows you the extent to which culturally 1066 is a key moment in our own understanding of our history, that people are connecting themselves to it, connecting their families to it, connecting ancestors to it, and mythologizing around it. And I just think that that just shows actually the importance of this moment in time beyond the direct political consequences. In terms of centuries of history later, we are still looking back to it and using it to answer questions about ourselves.
Yes, and well, nearly 1,000 years.
Yeah.
Yes. Let's close then with a question from Stephen, who asks, aside from Battle Abbey, what are the best English heritage sites to visit that tell the story of the Norman conquest? So where can we go and experience this podcast again, or perhaps all the other series of podcasts within a particular location in England that really evokes the Battle of Hastings?
I'll start your journey at Pevensey Castle, where William landed.
Roy, do you have any others?
I do, yeah. I mean, if you think about the consequences of the Battle of Hastings, think about what's going to happen in the years immediately after the battle, with hundreds of castles being developed across the country, being founded, and you can go to many of those, which are in the care of English Heritage. If you want to go to one which has a great link with the Battle of Hastings, go to Castle Acre Castle, which is where William de Warenne, who fought at the Battle of Hastings, established a house, a fortified house, effectively. You can see the remains of it to this day. And the other great thing which changed, of course, after the Battle of Hastings were great churches. The great churches of this country were rebuilt after the Norman conquest. If you go to St. Augustine's Abbey in Canterbury, where both Catherine and I happen to work, you will see very clearly the results of the Norman conquest, because the Anglo-Saxon church was demolished and the Norman church, a much bigger church, plonked on top of it. And you can see the remains of both. The Anglo-Saxon remains are very much below ground, whereas the remains of the Norman church are above ground.
Whereabouts are all these? You've got Canterbury, you've got Pevensey, which is that West Sussex?
It's East Sussex.
East Sussex. East Sussex.
Yeah.
And Canterbury is in Kent.
Yeah.
So we have Castle Acre in Norfolk as well.
There is one other site, actually, I would recommend, which is Old Sarum.
In Wiltshire, near Salisbury.
That's right, near Salisbury, down in Wiltshire. And if you go to Old Sarum, at the centre of the site is a motte, a mound, which is part of the castle founded by William the Conqueror. But that's not the only reason for going there. The reason I'd go there is because it's where William, in 1086, in the summer of 1086, summoned all the major landowners of England to come and swear allegiance to him. And it's where the great Domesday Survey was collated as well. So if you want a bookend of William the Conqueror's reign, you've got Pevensey and Battle Abbey at one end, right at the beginning, and you've got Old Sarum right at the end.
Yes, I was about to say, we can't forget Battle Abbey, which of course is in the town of Battle, so named because of the Battle of Hastings.
That's right. And in fact, we also, in terms of visiting Battle Abbey, a very good time to go will be in just a few weeks' time, because we have a reenactment of the battle taking place actually on the anniversary of the battle itself, on Saturday the 14th of October. This doesn't happen too often, but it was fought on Saturday the 14th of October 1066. On Saturday the 14th of October and on Sunday the 15th of October this year, you can go to Battle Abbey and see a reenactment of that terribly important fight.
You've been listening to the English Heritage Podcast. Next week, we'll be back to discover the stories of Porchester Castle's Black and Mixed Heritage prisoners of war.
About 2,512 prisoners had survived the journey, 333 white soldiers, 2,080 black soldiers, women and children, 99. So it was a pretty horrendous journey.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.